entire universe, the great earth, in all directions, in its entirety, is our true body, is the Dharma body. It's kind of an unusual statement. It's a statement coming from the special transmission outside the sutras. Because in the sutras, it said that the Dharma body is like vast space. It's not a physical thing. But here in Zen, they say that this, the world, the great earth in 10 directions, and the universe with all its things, is the Dharma body and our true body. But we are talking about not the particular things, but the entirety of the great earth and universe all at once, which is too big for us to even wrap our minds around. Therefore, maybe not so different from vast space. And another implication of this that we didn't talk about this morning is the environmental implications. If the great earth is our true body, what a wonderful statement for our modern times and taking care of this earth. If everyone could recognize the great earth as their true body, we would probably take better care of it. Any thoughts from this morning or about these three bodies of Buddha? Yes.
What do you mean by our?
Our.
It's our. It's mutual. We're all connected. Physically.
Well, if we go to the original phrase here, the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. And one translation has it as the entire universe is your true Dharma body, or it could be translated as our true Dharma body, but like the self's. But if we go with the original language, it kind of sounds like it's not exactly shared. It's the implication is that it's each of us has our own universe. So this often comes up around teachings about like the one mind and so on. Do we mean that all beings are just the same mind, or is it, do we have individual minds? When we talk about the storehouse consciousness, is there one collective unconscious, like Jung might speak of, or is it individual streams of vast consciousness? And in Zen, we often say, you know, not one, not two. To say it's this one vast consciousness, starts to sound maybe too metaphysical or too
neglects the particular.
It neglects the particular. Yeah, and it neglects the when we're talking about, for example, the storehouse consciousness has its unique karmic tendencies, and that is actually what make us all unique, and to say that that's all mushed into one mushy mind that we might
differentiate.
Yeah, yeah, we maybe miss the particularity, but if we say that we have these individual minds that are completely discrete and separate, that misses the interconnectedness and the way we all affect each other on the level of mind as well as in practical levels. So that's talking about mind. I think when we talk about all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just one mind, as ancestor Huangbo said, I would understand that as, you know, not just one big mushed together mind and not completely separate individual minds, but an inconceivable mind. Now, how do we get off into mind? Because we're talking about the Dharmakaya, but I think it's very related. The Dharmakaya is, as we were exploring this morning, this non-dual awareness that is Buddha nature come to fruition as the Dharmakaya. So it's kind of an awareness. It's kind of like a mind, beyond mind, you know, in the sutra version. So now that we have the Zen problem to say that the entire universe is the Dharma body of myself, yourself, ourself. So we could deduce that there's some relationship then between the universe and mind, and then we have this question: is there one universe? This, as we might commonly think, according to a scientific view, that yeah, there's all one universe. We can agree on it. It has Pluto, Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and like we don't have our own Pluto, Jupiter, and Mars. But from a mind-centered view, we actually say, yeah, we do actually have our own Jupiter. We have our individual versions of Jupiter. We can't find an objective Jupiter that outside of our mind. So maybe just add some more layers of confusion.
Unless someone missed astronomy 101 and has no conception of Jupiter, Pluto.
Which, of course, many people have. Many people in the world haven't had astronomy 101, right? They might look up in the sky and see these lights, but they don't see it as Jupiter. And therefore, do we say that it's not Jupiter for them? Maybe so. You know, we shouldn't force those, native tribal cultures that don't have astronomy to hold the view that that light there, they see as Jupiter. They say, no, that's like, that's the night goddess. We say, no, that's so wrong. It's Jupiter. And they think we're crazy. So that's an example of that's, in fact, that's like a version of the classic example giving proof that all things are of the nature of mind. That there's not like that light up there is not truly an objective Jupiter. It's just because certain minds call it that, and certain minds call it the night goddess, and other minds don't even see it at all. In which case, it's not even a planet. It's not even a light if they don't see it.
Have you seen the light?
Jiro, did you have
something? Well, earlier I was going to suggest that
we can go back. This is we've gone like out into outer space.
This is the analogy, old analogy, but still helpful, of the ocean and the waves, because the waves are every wave. The ocean belongs to every wave in its own way, and the ocean, the wave has its own unique energy and formation and time.
So the waves would be like individual minds or us, but then what would the ocean be?
That would be the
Dharmakaya.
Ocean. Yeah, since the Dharmakaya is inconceivable, I almost drew this chart in Zazen, this picture arose in my mind, but maybe I can explain it. That's kind of maybe touches on this. It was about the three bodies of Buddha. It was a picture of like a person with a like a circle in their body, right? And that's like us with a Buddha nature, in us in a way. Not exactly in us. It's not locatable, but it's like the Buddha nature, wrapped up in the delusion that we call a sentient being. Some people would even go so far as to say the thing that obscures the Buddha nature is called a sentient being. So if we're dropping off the obscurations, we're actually dropping off the sentient being. It's kind of a fun way to put it, but... and what is the sentient being? It's who we think we are. So if we drop off who we think we are, then there's just the Buddha nature left. And so in this picture, here's this circle. And then up here, there's an identical circle, and that's like the Dharmakaya, because it actually is, in a way, identical to the circle, but it's now, the sentient being's been shed. So there's like a, you could have like an arrow going up to this circle up here, of the Dharmakaya, without the delusion of a separate sentient being. So it's just a circle of light, and then you'd have these two arrows coming off of this one, going down to another, what looks like another person. It would look identical to this one down here with the same circle in them, but now it's the Nirmanakaya, it's the transformation body. So this person and this are not identical. This is like the Buddha nature hidden in a sentient being, and this is the Buddha nature manifesting as a manifestation body of Buddha. Can you kind of picture this picture? And the same circle is the kind of traveling through, right? And it doesn't really go in reverse. It goes this one direction. And then you have another little arrow going off here to the bliss body, like Amitabha. Or maybe it wouldn't be... Here's the ground. The bliss body is like... there's a cloud here. Amitabha's pure land is like in a cloud.
You're doing this during Zazen?
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. It gives me hope.
The last period. I didn't do it. It just arose.
from the Dharmakaya.
Maybe the Dharmakaya was helping me.
A gift from emptiness. Just appear.
So the circle. And then, so that's kind of like one individual person's like journey to Buddhahood, you could say. They start here, now they're just the dark, almost like disembodied Dharmakaya, then they manifest as a body and as this bliss body that is only visible to certain bodhisattvas. And that's a one individual stream. And then, well, how do we add in the other people? So then you could draw the same, you could duplicate that image next to it over here. And so now I have, now for the top of the picture, we have these two circles, or like infinite thousands of circles all in a row. And then there's this big circle. You could almost draw the people like all around in a circle. And there's this big sphere that contains all the Dharmakaya circles up at the top and unites them all. So that the, the bliss bodies and the transformation bodies are unique. Looks like they're unique to the sentient being that used to exist, because that sentient being made a vow. I, this particular sentient being, we can probably read in the Pure Land Sutras what his name was. I make this vow that I will create pure land when I'm a Buddha. So there's this unique pure land created by this particular person called the Western Pure Land. And then we have the Eastern Pure Land created by Medicine Master Buddha, by Shaja Guru's Eastern Pure Land, because he was like, had a different vow that he'd create one in the East. And so the transformation bodies are unique, the pure lands and bliss bodies are unique, but the Dharmakayas I picture like all in the circle. This is this was sparked by what Jero just said, that they're like they're indistinguishable. The Dharmakaya is like the same, exactly the same for every being. But, you know, the journey through from ascension being to the Dharmakaya and then back to a transformation body, you know, it passes through this universal Dharmakaya that's like the ocean. And then, is it like each of those circles is like a wave in that one big circle of ocean? Or is it like, I mean, these are all just images and metaphors. It's inconceivable. To say in our memorial services for monthly memorials for Suzuki Roshi and Koban, we do a monthly memorial, and we say the pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. The power of Buddha's great vows reveals coming and going. That's the
reveals
coming and going. This is in the dedication. So it's like the pure Dharmakaya in that circle up there. It doesn't appear and disappear. It's not different for different beings. It's universal, empty awareness with no characteristics. And then Buddha's vows reveals these transformation bodies that come and go in response to beings. So it's a little like in the dedication, there's this little like teaching about the Dharmakaya and the, I would say, Nirmanakaya. And it's kind of implying that you know, the founder of a temple is like a Nirmanakaya. It's a little bit like, say, it's like there's this Dharmakaya that manifests this particular person like Suzuki Roshi or Koban Chino Roshi, and they come and go. They have a limited lifespan. So something maybe like the waves in an ocean. But then we have this problem here, it seems like, of that the whole universe, or the great earth, is now we're talking about this circle of ocean, inconceivable circle of ocean, that everybody, all the bodhisattvas tap into when they become Buddha. They all join together up there. We could maybe even say that one's kind of mushy. That's the indistinguishable mushy body, the Dharmakaya. Because it's not even mind, you know. The storehouse consciousness is individual, but when its individuality is removed, all its karmic traces are removed, and it's just now the Dharmakaya. I picture like there's not even any particularity in that Dharmakaya. But now we say that is the whole universe. That's the earth, the entire earth. So then I guess we have the question of, is it this earth that we see around us? Is this that universal Dharmakaya, according to this Zen teaching? Yeah. Is it our Dharma, when we actually realize the Dharmakaya, then are we actually just one with the great earth? Are we the universe? Or is that mind, is that awareness, like just the universe itself, because it's free from any limitation?
Does
it have an aspect in this empty awareness of knowing?
Yeah, I mean, all these words, we have to be really careful when we start talking about these things, but sometimes we use the word knowing Hongzhi, one of the Chinese ancestors that Dogen greatly respected, and in talking about Zazen mind, and maybe we're talking here about the Zazen that's like tapping into the Dharmakaya. Mm-hmm. He says is knowing without touching things. This is this Zazen Xin poem, maybe you've heard. Knowing without touching things. So that's the kind of knowing that's like this, I would say this kind of awareness. It's like a knowing but without touching things, meaning like right now, like I know this is a piece of paper, but like my mind is touching it. Mm-hmm. It's like it's contacting an object. So this is like knowing without contacting objects. It's like a subjectless, objectless knowing. So not a usual kind of knowing. But sometimes, I mean, it's called jnana, as we were talking about. Nirvikalpa jnana is one name for it. Meaning that nirvikalpa is like without any imagination, imputation, or conceptuality. But jnana is, in Sanskrit, it has that same root as the Sanskrit and English, you know, have many similar roots. So jnā, that jnā sound that's in vijñāna and prajñā, is the same root as knowing in English. So like, or gnosis, like a GM, you know, the Latin and the Sanskrit are related in this case. So knowing, knowledge, gnosis are related to prajna, which is, I think, like complete knowing, and jnana is also a kind of complete, non-dual knowledge or awareness without touching things. And not divided, not a vijnana. Not divided into a subject and object. And to our dualistic consciousness, that kind of knowing is inconceivable. I mean, but then part of the wonderful thing is, here it is right now, according to the teachings. It's with us right now, but it's obscured by the vijñāna. Sometimes it's spoken like, you might have heard that term, transformation of the basis. Paraviti is like the basis in this case. It's a Yogacara thing. The storehouse consciousness is transformed into this perfect mirror, jnana, non-touching gnosis, wisdom, non-dual awareness. But I've heard Buddhist scholar who I greatly respect say, actually, more technically speaking, the way it works is it's not so much that you transform something into something else. It's not so much that you transform the storehouse consciousness that's all infiltrated with dualistic conceptuality. It's not that you transform that magically into this non-dual mirror awareness. It's more that it's the same thing of like the obscurations to the mirror awareness are dropped away. And you could say the obscurations are called the storehouse consciousness. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much a transformation as a dropping away of the illusion. And I've heard one Zen teacher, and I think this might be sort of standard too, but is Shodo Harada Roshi, Rinzai Zen teacher, talking about these four wisdoms, these four jnanas in Yogacara thought. And, you know, he's a Zen teacher, so he can say anything. You know, it's, you know, the set for transmission outside the scriptures is very good to us. Because we don't have to adhere tightly to what it says in the scriptures, but we, I think we also don't want to just randomly make stuff up. We want to, you know, we want to accord with it and with skillful means find a way into these really difficult teachings. Anyway, he was saying, talking about these four wisdoms, the perfect mirror, wisdom, gnosis, jnana, and how the path opens up these wisdoms, and like at different stages or something. Or like, so I asked him something like, is there a progression to opening up these different kinds of wisdom, which are basically like the true nature of the eight consciousnesses. Mm-hmm. These four wisdoms are like the true nature of the Yogacara eight consciousnesses. And he said something like, as I recall, well, yeah, there is this, you know, through zazen and practice, you these are kind of like transformed or revealed to be these wisdoms. But he says this perfect mirror wisdom, that one's here with us all the time. And that's like the true nature, you could say, of the storehouse consciousness. And he said that one, you don't have to do anything about it. It's like it's already here right now as we're speaking. But we're like, you know, it's blocked by our thinking that I'm over here and you're over there, like that.
So can I be skeptical or heretical and sort of ask, like, are we getting too much into splitting hairs? Like, if the purpose of Buddhism is to relieve suffering, then is it just important? Is it just enough to say, to throw out a few phrases like the entire universe is a Dharma body of the self, or things as it is, or talk about how things are separate but things are one, and then just say if you embody that. Things are going to be different. You're going to be like Suzuki Roshi. You're going to buy the rotten vegetables because you feel sorry for them, or you're going to be like the Buddha and come back again. Even though you come back again, even though you got enlightened, you're going to and you could just forget about it. You can't do that. You've got to come back and you've got to save all beings and that. So yeah, I'm thinking if it's to relieve suffering and it's about what we do and that is it just enough to point to those sort of things and that could
well, another way to put this might be you know, can we just hear the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self, and depending on maybe our karmic tendencies, we might hear that and just like our Buddha nature string starts like vibrating intensely in resonance with that statement that's maybe coming to us from the Dharmakaya. But sometimes we might hear a statement like that and be like, the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self? Huh? Or like sounds like a Zen thing, but like that doesn't help. Like my legs hurt. This has nothing to do with my hurting legs. You know, this doesn't relieve suffering. So I think it depends, you know, and I think Dogen's always playing with this. And even in this essay, he's saying, in fact, this is a good example, right, because he says, he kind of starts pushing these questions, right? Like, you better not be hindered by the Dharmakaya or you'll drown in the ocean of suffering, right? So he's like, so how can you be free from this hindrance? And just kind of like what you're saying, how can you keep the Dharma body alive and avoid sinking in the ocean of suffering? Just say, quote, the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. Done! So in a way, I take that as kind of like what you're saying. So for some people, it's enough to just like, well, what about the hindrance? And like, we have to explain this. And he just repeats back the same sentence. No explanation necessary. But then we might, we can also unpack it. And Dogen does that sometimes too. And you could say, because this is again Zero Way Sashimi, we're splitting some hairs. because you have the time to do it. but it's also a really good point that that this is all about relieving suffering, and that all these things are hopefully always pointing back towards that. And if we get too lost in the hair splitting and these technical arguments and so on, then we might miss that point or forget that point. So, good reminder. And, you know, and I think it's different for different people. I think also, like, Zen and a lot, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, is it can be a really, like, faith-based path, like
sort of an other power.
Yeah. If we have great faith and trust,
something will take care of us.
Yeah.
From out there.
Yeah, and we can, and also it's also about trust in the teacher. So, like, if we're really like trust Dogen, we can just hear him say some of these things that sound really wacky, and just be like, I feel like Dogen's this old friend. I've just spent so much time with him that sometimes he says some weird things, and I usually don't argue with him too much. I kind of like, cool. That's just sort of, that was really from left field, but let me just take that in. You know, sometimes I might try to argue with him some, but it's kind of like, and Dogen himself says, for shikantaza, for just sitting, start with this great faith that you are already Buddha, or faith in your Buddha nature, perfect from the beginning. And he just kind of says that. He doesn't explain why you're perfect from the beginning, but he says, if you believe him or believe that teaching, then you can really just sit and drop into it. So there are people who have karmic tendencies of like faith, and I think all kinds of things, a lot of our ritual things are about faith. You know, I think chanting the names of the ancestors, things like that, are like invoking this faith in the lineage and the Buddhas and so on. And then there's also a path of like inquiry that's maybe like kind of maybe for doubting types that don't have so much faith. Then we maybe need to split some more hairs. And yeah, I think I recognize certain of those tendencies, both sides of myself. But I'm also a doubting type, which is why things like, you know, Nagarjuna and like logic, like the Indian Mahayanists are totally into like logical proof for everything. You know, just say everything's vast emptiness, because it's like, well, sounds nice, but I don't believe it, or I don't know what that means. So intricately, painstakingly, you can go through these proofs that Nagarjuna puts forth, and you can like logically prove that nothing can truly exist. And so for certain types, that works. For certain types, that doesn't work at all, but then they might have faith. And those are just two. I think there's others too.
Like, people might have great faith and enjoy splitting hairs just for the fun of it.
Uh-huh.
A hybrid.
A
devotional hybrid.
Or they might have great doubt and have to split hairs, but just, you know, bring forth some faith just for the fun of it. Like, I think also Indian yoga, you know, they talk about all these different kinds of yogas that are entrances to reality. So they have bhakti yoga, is the path of faith, or devotional, total devotional, like all out, throwing yourself on the floor through singing.
Surrender
to the guru.
Yeah.
And so devotion and faith, I think, are very similar. The bhakti path for certain types of alaya vijnana, for certain types of storehouse consciousness that have those karmic dispositions, that's the way. And then they have jnana yoga, that's the same jnana that we were talking about, is like the path of kind of reasoning and analysis and wisdom, and then they have, you know, asana, yoga, the body postures, pranayama, using the breath, and all these different nodes.
Kriya.
Yeah. I think there's one that's, is it jnana? There's one that's, I think, like scriptural study. So many paths. So that's what I think, again, I really appreciate this form of Genzo Ei Sesshin, because it's not just like a class where we split a lot of hairs and read a lot of stuff and then go home and split some more hairs, non-dharma hairs. Something. It's like we split some hairs and then we go into zazen. So we're like back and forth between like experiential, just sitting, letting go of all this conceptual stuff, and then back into the conceptual stuff and back and forth. For me, this kind of thing works quite well.
So just, what are the three characteristics, three things you need to solve a koan? It's great faith, great doubt, and I've forgotten the third one.
Determination. Yeah. Yeah, this Hakuin's three parts of practice. I think he comments on it like that too, is that first you have great faith in Buddha nature. I think he even talks about it like that, like that, just like Dogen does, that our true nature is completely free from all suffering and totally compassionate, wise, and radiant. And then so you have that faith, and then immediately following on that you have the doubt that but I don't feel like that. I don't see that, or really. So it's almost like they're completely linked. And then the determination is, let's resolve this problem, that the faith and the doubt seem like they're opposite. How can we resolve this? Can we go a little further?
Yes.
An ancient Buddha said, this is that page 2, but almost halfway. An ancient Buddha said, the entire universe, and again, this is in the original, it actually says, the entire great earth is the true human body. So it's another version. And this, by the way, this ancient Buddha is the same ancient Buddha, Changsha, who likes talking this way. The entire universe is the true human body. The entire universe is the gate of liberation. The entire universe is the eye, literally it says, the one eye of Vairochana. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. And you might remember that Vairochana, pure Dharmakaya. Vairochana is like the name of the Dharmakaya. So it's also emphasizing that again, the entire universe is the one eye of the Dharmakaya, Vairochana. So in this case, Dogen's not just going to leave it at that and say, there you have it. He's going to unpack it a little bit line by line, but of course he's going to unpack it in his Dogen-like way that just leaves you a new koan with each sentence. The true human body, says the first of these four sentences. The entire universe is the true human body. True human body means your own true body. Know that the entire universe is your own true body, which is not a temporary body. Another translation says an imaginary body. So I think we're not talking about our version of the universe or the great earth. We think the earth, so we picture like a picture of a globe, or we like look over the horizon, like out there, and like there's the earth, there's my body. I think that's just our conception, our imagination. But this entire universe is not a temporary coming and going body. It's the universe, or the great earth, beyond our imagination of it. And then, then Dogen says, if someone asks you why we do not usually notice this, it goes back to Tony's point. Here's another faith thing, right? If somebody doubts this, right, and says, well, why don't we notice this, this non-temporary true human body of the universe, just say to them, he's giving these instructions, if somebody else comes to you and doubts it. I know you wouldn't doubt it.
I think he's talking to his monks at Heiji, possibly.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
If someone asks you, or if you ask yourself, why we don't notice this, just say, just reflect within yourself that the entire universe is the true human body. Kind of like, just look inward to see this. Which is maybe the point is not so much looking out there, like, sorry, to examine the grasses and stones of the world out there. Look inward to discover this. Or, if that doesn't work, say, the entire universe is the true human body. Already you know this. That's a great one, I think.
It stops all conversation.
And it's kind of saying that, like, pointing to this Buddha nature, that, like, you have this already, and some part of you knows this, even though it's a totally absurd statement. And you find this in Zen sayings throughout. Like, it comes to mind the one about the whole universe in 10 directions is one bright pearl. How can I understand this? The monk says. I heard you say the whole universe in 10 directions is one bright pearl. How can I understand this? And the teacher says, the whole universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. What's it got to do with understanding? And it works. I think the monk wakes up at that point. So it's kind of like, don't try to figure this out. And it's just like the truth beyond your understanding of it. And you already know it. You already know that. Don't try to figure this out. You already got it, totally. I think that's one of the great lines in here. Just tell those people, those doubting people, this is just the way it is, and you already know it. I have no doubt. Also, now the next sentence, the entire universe is the gate of liberation, means that you are not at all entangled or captivated. This is another wonderful statement, that since the whole universe is the gate of liberation, of freedom, means that you're not entangled or captivated by the universe. What is called the entire universe is undivided or not separate from the moment, the ages or years, mind and words. So this entire universe is not separate from this moment. This entire universe as the Dharmakaya is here right now. We're not talking about some other time and place. It's also not separated from all the past times, like when Dogen said it, the same exact thing, nothing's changed. It's not separate from mind, which is a key point. This whole thing is actually, that we're talking about is actually mind, and not separate from words, like these words that are talking about it. Even though the words aren't it, these words are not separate from it, like Dogen said earlier. Something like how Buddha's Buddha discoursed freely without words getting in the way this morning. So this is like, words are here talking about the universe in 10 directions, but they're not getting in the way. It's the this limitless and boundless experience is the entire universe. And it looked like these characters, Shinmitsu, actually mean more literally like intimate and sweet, or like sweet nectar. Even though two different translations say limitless and boundless experience, the characters mean this, we could say that this intimate sweet, or intimate nectar-like experience is the entire universe. Even if you seek to enter or go through this gate of liberation, it cannot be done. And maybe one possibility there is that you, if you seek to enter this gate of liberation, it cannot be done. It's like the entire universe is the gate of liberation. So it's like, let's go through it now. We're already like continuously going through it. So it's like, to think that like now I'm gonna, little me is gonna walk through that gate. We're too small to do that. We're already completely immersed in the gate. How is this so? Reflect on the question raised. If you intend to seek outside what it is, nothing will be attained. This is us also similar to the very beginning of the essay, right? Where anything that you think about realization beforehand is not a help for realization, and will, upon realization, you'll see that it's far different than what you thought. It's a little bit like, if you intend to seek outside what this gate of liberation is, nothing will be attained. And anything we think about it is outside it. Even though it's undivided from words. It's not separate from our thoughts about it, but thinking that we're going to like do something to go through it blocks it, the gate. The entire universe is the eye of Vairochana, means that Buddhas have a single eye. Do not suppose that a Buddha's eye is like those of human beings. Here, I thought of Meister Eckhart. Do you know this saying? Famous saying of Meister Eckhart says, the eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me. Or vice versa. I guess it wouldn't matter. The eye with which God sees me is the same eye with which I see God. There's one eye that looks in both ways. The way, which is a lot like the pulley looking at the well is only 80%, but the well looking back at the pulley completes the picture. Maybe same principle as Meister Eckhart. And in this case, we have the eye, the entire universe is the eye of Vairochana, the eyeball. Means that Buddhas have a single eye. Do not suppose that a Buddha's eye is like those of human beings. Human beings have two eyes, but when you say a human eye, you don't say two eyes or three eyes. Those who study the teaching should not understand that the eye of a Buddha, the eye of Dharma, or the celestial or Deva eye, is like the two eyes of human beings. To believe that it is like human eyes is lamentable. Understand now that there is only a Buddha's single eye, which is itself the entire universe. The whole universe is Buddha's eye. Looking at us. I feel self-conscious. Staring at us constantly. But it's our eyes that are looking at Buddha at the same time. And it's not like human eyes. This is true Dharma eyes. A Buddha may have 1,000 eyes or myriad eyes, but presently it is said that the entire universe is the one eye of Vairochana. Therefore, it's not mistaken to say that this eye is one of many eyes of a Buddha, just as it's not mistaken to understand that a Buddha has only one eye. A Buddha indeed has many kinds of eyes. Three eyes. 1,000 eyes or 84,000 eyes. And it may be that Buddha, these particular numbers are that Buddha has these three eyes, because We've got the third eye. It seems to be this kind of like universal spiritual teaching, right? There's a chakra at the so-called third eye, and Buddha statues often have that little bump at the third eye, like the wisdom eye. And I don't know if you've heard this one about the pineal gland. Do you know about the pineal gland? There's the pineal gland is a gland behind, right in this location, apparently, in the body. And one, I think, recent discovery is that there's a small amount of the chemical called DMT in the pineal, produced by the pineal gland.
DMT
is a psychedelic substance that opens up different dimensions of reality. So they say when we die, one theory is that when we die, the DMT from the pineal gland is released into the mind stream and helps us kind of like enter the bardo, this in-between state where there's this visionary world created by our karmic tendencies, and it's not nothing. Anyway, that's a whole other discussion. It's not nothing, but interesting kind of scientific, new scientific discoveries about the third eye, chemically speaking.
The pineal gland is deep in the brain, right?
Is it? I'm not sure if it's on the surface.
It's on
deep.
The frontal lobe, or is it?
I don't know.
I thought it was more.
I don't know.
Back in the limbic area.
Is it? It's inside the skull.
Yeah. I believe so.
But right at that location, so it's back though.
Kind of right in the middle of the head.
Right in the middle, but right behind this location.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. So, yeah, there may be... And all the subtle body stuff with these chakras, I think none of it's random. Somebody didn't say, let's just say there's some wheels inside the human body. No, I think this is like ancient yogic stuff, and both Chinese and Indian systems agree on a lot of these subtle energy channels and stuff. So maybe we'll find out more and more scientifically.
There's a crown chakra too.
Yeah.
Isn't it where the when a baby's born there's a soft spot? There's some connection there.
Shoho and I are in a few weeks going on a POA retreat. Do you know POA? Yeah. POA is it's a Tibetan term. POA is ejection of consciousness, and it's this it's this training that you can do to the top of your central channel that ends up at the top of your head, and it's learning through this training to get your consciousness moving upward through the central channel so that at the time of death you can eject your consciousness out the top of your head. And it's that spot. Mm-hmm. I think it's that spot. And you kind of open up this spot, through mind power to be able to do that. And that you, because of that, then the story goes, and this is Tibetan tradition, that then you have more... your intention can work more freely than if you don't have that training. It basically goes out to your eyes and ears and nose and other orifices.
It leaks
out. So this is kind of like you're sort of yogically closing up all the other openings to send it out the top. We don't have this kind of stuff in Zen.
What's the purpose of wanting to go out the top only?
Focus, I guess.
It's like so that you have more you can intentionally choose what's going to happen next more easily. Mm-hmm. If instead of just being like swept away by your karma into a lower rebirth, you could direct your consciousness, and particularly we've been talking about Amitabha. It's like, according to these teachings, it's like so that you can more easily send your consciousness to this pure land after you die, where it's like Jikoji.
Living in bliss.
And you know, I think an important point about these pure lands, though, is it's not Buddhahood. It's not like the end of the path. It's like, cool, pure land, I'm done. It's just a zendo. It's just like it's a big Zen center where you still have to do the work of becoming a Buddha, but it's just the conditions are really good for it. It's really quiet.
I'd like to interject that sometimes the residents of this pure land of Jikoji find it to be a little less than bliss, occasionally. Other times, bliss, but
yeah, I was thinking,
it comes and goes.
Yeah, a friend of mine who came from the Tibetan tradition to Green Gulch some years ago, and she had all the teaching about pure lands and stuff, and she really felt like this, she called it, this is the Green Gulch pure land. She really felt like it was a pure land. It was like, this is exactly where I need to be. This is the perfect situation. I must have dreamed this up. And then she lived there for a while. And then it ceased to have that same visionary quality. Yes. But still, you know, we try to, with our vows, create great practice places for sentient beings to.
Situations.
Practice well.
What was that, before you go on, what was that practice that you were in?
Powa, so like Phowa. And, you know, I probably wouldn't end up doing it if Shoho is really into these Tibetan practices, and
my sister is Tibetan too. So mm-hmm.
I'm sure she knows of it. It's of the six yogas of Naropa.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of the six yogas of Naropa. So it's yogic, and these yogas of Naropa are like probably pre-Buddhist yogic practices that then got taken into Tibetan Buddhism.
And that's applied.
All involving the channels,
yeah.
Energy channels. It's applying what?
Just a lot of the tantric practices
are
applied. So there are specific activities for specific results.
Yeah.
So you kind of.
Yeah.
And you apply the practice expecting a certain kind of result.
Yeah.
So unlike our practice, we're a little looser that way.
We just go right to the end in a way. Start at the end and just say, drop off any idea of anything and just be here now. But we can learn consciousness ejection. Maybe if we're really clear in our practice, maybe we can, our subtle body will know what to do at that time anyway. The other yogas of Naropa are like dream yoga, so like learning lucid dreaming, the inner heat yoga where you're basically like pulling all your pranic chi energy into the central channel. And I think, you know, some of these things I think are happen in Zen practice. It's just that Zen is just like this really streamlined version of practice. So we say just sit. But when you just sit long enough, your energy becomes different. I'm sure you all know, like, you've energetically, something kind of shifts when you start sitting like a sesshin, and things your experience of the world, you know, subtly shifts a little too. So it's like, without even talking about it, I think Zen is a totally yogic practice, right? It's like body posture breath practice. There's a little divergence on three eyes.
There's 84.
And then 1,000 is like Avalokiteshvara, right? Has 1,000 an eye in each of the 1,000 hands in order to see skillfully how to help every being. The eye and the hand that can then, and the hand can come forward and help.
What's that called, you said?
That's 1,000 eyes. I think that's Dogen's reference when he says 3 eyes, 1,000 eyes, or 84,000 are common numbers of eyes in Buddha Dharma. 1,000, yeah, you may have seen the pictures of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, Great Compassion, with 1,000 arms. I mean, they're really distinctive image because there are 1,000.
What is it called?
It's where it's in here, it's a Buddha indeed has many kinds of eyes. 3 eyes, 1,000 eyes, maybe referring to Avalokiteshvara.
That's the word I want.
Avalokiteshvara? Guanyin in Chinese, or as we were talking about, Kanzeon, is the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Okay. It's a great image for compassion, right? 1,000 hands to help in 1,000 ways, but not like blindly getting in there and meddling around and messing things up. They have a wisdom eye on each hand that like let's discern what's most helpful here before we reach
plus,
in.
Plus many heads that are seen in all directions.
Oh. Heads, many heads. Too.
Loving heads.
That's
kind
great.
Of like a tower.
And the top head is Amitabha.
Amitabha.
Avalokiteshvara is like this. This bodhisattva is totally devoted to Amitabha. Yeah. Sometimes 11 heads, and the top head is Amitabha's head. She puts on top of hers, to, like we put the robe on top of her head. She put Amitabha's head there to pay homage to it. Amitabha is the one is the creator of the Western Pure Land. Don't be surprised to hear that there are eyes such as these. It's okay if you're surprised. But, you know, you don't need to be. Also learn that the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. This is the last line of Dogen. To seek to know the self is invariably the wish of living beings. However, those who see the true self are rare. Only Buddhas know the true self. People outside the way regard what is not the self as the self. But what Buddhas call the self is the entire universe. Therefore, there is never an entire universe that is not the self, with or without our knowing it. On this matter, defer to the words of the ancient Buddhas. Or refer to the words of the ancient Buddhas. So, we're talking about the true self here, being the entire universe. And in early Buddhism, true self would be like a totally taboo thing to say because it's all about no self, anatman. There's no abiding self, and they never would talk about true self, but in the Mahayana, you have the principle of the true self. In the Parinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra, which is all about Buddha nature, these qualities of Buddha nature are the opposite of these qualities of false views. So in early Buddhism we have we say the two marks of all conditioned things are impermanence, right? Impermanence, suffering, everything conditioned is not quite satisfactory, no self, and impure, everything is, as we were talking about purity the other day, everything is distorted by our conceptual thinking. So these four qualities are one of the most important lists in early Buddhism of like all conditioned things, the Buddha would say over and over, are impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, and impure. And then in the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra, flip it all. And we say these four qualities of Buddhahood called Goraku Gajo. If you know the Enmeijuku Kanangyo, that's one of the 10 lines, and there's Goraku Gajo, referring to these four, and they're the opposite. So instead of impermanence, it's permanent. Talking about Buddha nature now. It's permanent, unchanging, not coming and going. It's not suffering and dissatisfying. It's bliss. Buddha nature is bliss. It's not, this is maybe the most radical one, it's not no self, but it's self. That's, I think, most controversial. They're all kind of controversial, but to say that Buddha nature is true Atman, they even use the word Atman, and then it's, instead of impure, it's totally pure. So it's this great, like, positive teaching of the Mahayana. And there's sometimes called the transcendent four transcendences. So it's not like, because we're talking about Buddha nature, it's transcendent permanence. And it's transcendent bliss. It's transcendent purity. And it's transcendent self. So in Sanskrit, paramita. So it's the Atman paramita. Like we could say the self, the transcendent self, or the self that's gone beyond, is actually taught in the Mahayana. This might be shocking to some people, that there's a true self that's taught in the sutras. So this is not just the Dogen's Zen thing. Only Buddhas know the true self, which is like the you know, who we really are is this Buddha nature. What Buddhas call the self is the entire universe. Therefore, there is never an entire universe that's not the self, that's not Buddha nature manifested, with or without our knowing it. In this manner, just trust, defer to these old Buddhas. If you don't believe it, just believe it. Oh, yes. Naughty.